Hi, my name is Noel Bell, and today I'm chatting with Dr. John Rowan, much respected elder of Britain's psychotherapy scene, and one of our most incisive writers on the transpersonal. In this interview, John discusses the whole notion of integrative psychotherapy practice. Well known in the psychotherapy environment for his work on subpersonalities, his other books are Ordinary Ecstasy, Healing the Male Psyche, Therapy as Initiation, and more recently, Personification, Using the Dialogical Self in Psychotherapy and Counselling. I undertook the interview at John's house in Chingford in northeast London. So John, thanks for agreeing to have the chat. I'm really impressed by the number of cushions in this room. Is this one of your therapeutic rooms that you use?
It is the therapeutic room.
The therapy room.
Yeah.
An ex-Marxist living in Norman Tebbit territory of Chingford. How do you explain that one?
That's what you do, I mean.
But you're originally from the London area?
I'm not originally from anywhere, really. In my first 30 years, I lived in 30 different places.
Wow. Hard to pin down. I heard Spike Milligan once say that grovelling will get you nowhere, but you are known as the father of humanism, at least in the UK. But what I'd like to kind of focus on is where you see an integrative psychotherapeutic practice. So, can we just talk a little about what analysis has offered us in terms of tools and techniques, maybe its limitations, and then the thrust of humanism?
Psychoanalysis itself has quite a long history. The idea of the unconscious goes back into the 17th century, in fact. There's a wonderful book called The Unconscious, which has the whole history of all that. So Freud didn't invent the unconscious, but what he did was to explore it. Particularly through dreams, and his book on dreams is actually still worth reading. It's an extraordinarily honest book about his own dreams and this kind of thing. So he's not trying to kind of hide behind a theory. He's really exploring his own consciousness and the way it works, and he contributed an awful lot. They once did a survey of heads of psychology departments in American universities. There was a question, who's the greatest psychologist who ever lived? And Freud came out top of the list. Curious paradox is, those same heads of departments do not teach Freud. He's regarded as unscientific, and therefore is excluded from the actual teaching. So there's all kinds of paradoxes about Freud. And also, it's always very annoying to me the way in which psychoanalysts claim that Freud is behind every form of therapy known to man. You know, you only have to mention names like Carl Rogers and Moreno Alvin Mara, great humanistic psychologist, don't depend on Freud a bit, not at all. And so psychoanalysts are annoying to everybody other than psychoanalysts because they claim to be the proper therapists. Everything else derives from them and depends on them, but they have the pure doctrine unchanged and unspoiled from Freud, you see. And in their institutes, they want to have as their supervisors and teachers people who shook the hand of Freud, or who shook the hand, somebody who shook the hand of Freud, or somebody who, you know, shook the hand of Freud. And so there's a depressing kind of orthodoxy attaching to psychoanalysts. But, you know, there are some great psychoanalysts who are free of this taint. People like Bion and Winnicott, who are, you know, exempt, I think, from some of these criticisms.
Yeah, sure. Where would you see in your own worldview where people like maybe Adler, with his idea of birth order, came in? What relevance?
It's all good stuff. I mean, Adler's one of the people who influenced Carl Rogers, actually.
Mm.
His idea of sort of social interest is very relevant to any therapy that wants to be relevant to the social movements of the day and so forth. And of course, the latest extension of that is Ken Wilber's AQAL, which says that all quadrants, all levels, which says that always in therapy you should be paying attention to four quadrants.
Mm-hmm.
The internal consciousness, the social milieu, the social background of the person, then the fourth, bottom right quadrant is the great social background to all that, economics, sociology, this kind of stuff, and then the other quadrant is the physiological facts, factual stuff about physiology and neurophysiology and so forth. A lot of interest in that today, and I think that's right, that any proper form of dealing with the whole human being has to deal with those four quadrants.
I've been reading Brandt Courtright recently.
He's good.
He makes the point that it's bizarre that psychology, which claimed to provide a narrative of human existence, for so long had failed to take account of the spirit realm.
Oh, yeah.
Why?
Well, because in the 19th century, psychology established itself as a science. And that has an upside and a downside. The upside is that, like any science, it can actually grow, it can develop, it can be proper foundations, and you know why you're saying what you're saying and how it's based experimentally. Huge step forward in a way. Snag is that the model of science that they adopted was daft model of science, much too narrow, generally called positivism, positivist notion of science, which says that everything is either true or false. It's black or white. It's right or wrong. And this logic, which goes back to Aristotle, and is also the logic on which computers are founded, Boolean logic, behind computer models. This is absolutely fine for things. It works extremely well as long as you're studying things. Doesn't work for people, because people are not black and white. People are not either or. People are not either this or that. They're this and that. And the other as well. In other words, for dealing with human beings, you need a different kind of logic, and which is hard to pin down in the same way that you can pin down the positivist type of logic, etc. And I call it dialectical logic, and Ken Wilber calls it vision logic, and there are various other ways of describing it, second-tier thinking, is another way of putting it. And that's what we need for human beings. Because, to put it simply, the basic statement of formal logic is A is A. See, that sounds more or less unchallengeable, doesn't it? But the dialectical logic, the basic statement at the same level, is A is not simply A.
Mm-hmm.
See, and that's why it's useful for dealing with human beings, because you come into my therapy room, I say, no is no. Well, that doesn't give me much to go on, really. No is no, so... No. But if the statement is, no is not simply no, that gives us something to work on. It gives us some opening that something might happen, some revelation might appear. So if no is not simply no, what else is it? What do we not know about no yet that we need to know?
Yeah. You also wrote extensively on subpersonalities.
Yeah, which I've now gone off, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yes, I can actually give you the book, take away with you.
Okay. I hope you'll sign it as well.
Oh, yeah. I positions, that's the new word, I positions. This comes from a development called the dialogical self. From a guy called, started with a guy called Hubert Hermans in the Netherlands. And there's a big conference coming off in August in The Hague, which should be quite big, I think, probably about 500, 600 people. And I'm looking forward to that. But the idea of I positions is more sophisticated than the idea of subpersonalities. Because subpersonalities give you two drawbacks. One is that it lends itself to reification. In other words, if you have a subpersonality, did you have it yesterday? Are you going to have it tomorrow? What's its history? What's its how important is it? And so forth. And there's an it there, in other words, called a subpersonality.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of an I position is that it's same old I all over the place, but it takes up this position in this situation, it takes up this position in that situation, it takes up a different position in another situation, and so forth. And so an I position doesn't lend itself to reification in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, the other drawback is with subpersonalities, it's always sub something, so less than the whole person, and so forth. But with an I position, it can also be super, as well as sub. So you can have a conversation with your soul, as Brent Courtright suggests. Or you can talk to God. You know, there's a whole series of books called Conversations with God. You know, well, they're not sub anything. So you can't call them sub-personalities, but you can call them my position.
You're listening to an interview with Dr. John Rowan, with me, Noel Bell. I've heard you speak in the past about your cushion work, and we're certainly surrounded by quite a few cushions in this room we're in at the moment.
Okay.
I've got two questions around this, really. A, can old tools and techniques be called transpersonal if you're in a transpersonal framework? And B, can a materialistic atheist client come and see a transpersonal practitioner?
Well, I didn't particularly call myself a transpersonal practitioner. I'm an everything practitioner. I have a lot of strings to my bow. The beauty of the idea of I positions is they could use it at any level of consciousness. They'd have to be transpersonal, any level of consciousness. So if you say, well, you know, on the one hand, I want to go to Paris and spend a lot of time there. On the other hand, I want to spend more time in my study, going deeper into things and so forth. Well, you could explore that conflict, that inner conflict, with the use of cushions. Well, this one did, this one that, so on. It's useful for anything, see. On the other hand, if you say, well, you know, sometimes I wonder if my soul understands my ego, you could do that with cushions as well. There's a whole range of things. So it's not restricted to any one level of work. You could use cushions, even if you're a psychoanalyst, you know. You could say, well, my conscious mind says this, but my unconscious says that, you know. Okay, well, what's the reply to that?
Even in analysis, there are people like, say, Michael Egan.
Yeah.
Who talk about the mysticism.
Brilliant, yes. I love Michael Egan. He's a very, very interesting guy.
So I guess tools and techniques, to be truly integrative, we're really using anything and everything to meet the needs of the client.
Yeah. And my quarrel with most of what's called integrative approaches is that they leave out the transpersonal altogether. Most of the books on integrative psychotherapy have nothing to say about the transpersonal.
But equally, a lot of integrative transpersonal pay lip service to CBT.
Well, CBT is an honest game. It's nothing hideous about it.
I agree, but some training courses under the transpersonal umbrella, integrative, will just include one lecture on CBT, and I'm often left wondering, is that sufficient?
Well, that's a good question. I haven't got the answer, but I think it's a good question. And also, I don't know one single integrative course that covers primal work. It seems to be primal is extremely important form of therapy, and to call your course integrative and not include that seems to be utterly absurd. They all do it. And so I call transpersonal and the primal the terrible twins of psychotherapy, because it's ever so easy to leave them out.
Yeah.
I don't want to bother with that.
Yeah.
Too much to ask.
Yeah. Do you make any distinction in tools and techniques that you would use for a client in short-term therapy? Say, for instance, you had time restricted for whatever reason, whether you're working perhaps in an organizational setting or even in private practice, where you could only see someone for maybe 6 to 8 sessions. Would that dictate the kind of tools and techniques you would employ?
Oh, absolutely, because if you've got short-term work, you generally have goals, or a goal, or some goals. However many goals you've got time for. Whereas in long-term work, having goals is a complete no-no. You must not have goals in long-term work. Goals is out. Forget about goals.
Because I've heard someone say that in longer-term work, even still, the early sessions are the well of information. What do you think of that? Or do you think the initial sessions are just, you know, the presenting issues can often just be a smokescreen for what the real problem is?
Yeah, I'm not very interested in presenting issues. I think they're a good, they're your ticket for getting in, so to speak. Have to have a presenting issue, otherwise we won't see you. But it's all bullshit, really. I mean, what I'm interested in, and I think what most good therapists are interested in, is the whole person who's in the room, you know, not the one slice that they've chosen to present.
You've talked in the past about ways of being as a therapist, and you've said Clarkson's book is a must-read for all therapists.
I think so, yes.
But you also said she's pretty poor on transpersonal.
Yes. Not everybody's got their strengths and their weaknesses. I think her strength is emphasising that there are five relationships all going on at the same time, and to regard it as just one is simply a mistake, and a mistake that I think most therapists make, it's a common mistake.
I've also heard you speak about practicing. Do you let the therapy unravel, or do you have at the back of your mind an internal map that you refer to, or do you just let go as well?
I let go as well. I mean, I have written about a possible map, which is the map used by the alchemists, and expatiated upon by Jung and a lot of the other Jungians as well. Because I think the alchemical model alerts you to a lot of the more subtle things that can happen in long-term therapy. And in particular, the importance of the negredo, that is, the importance of negative episodes in therapy, that, when things go wrong in therapy and the client gets completely upset and thinks of leaving and this kind of thing, that's some of the most valuable stuff. And the alchemical model makes it clear that they are just as much a part of the process as the nicer, more positive things that can happen. And this is part of the dialectical aspect of the whole therapy, that if something is good, the opposite can also be good. My great teacher, Bill Swartley, used to say that if something isn't working, try the exact opposite.
You're listening to an interview with Dr. John Rowan, with me, Noel Bell. Dream work, the alchemical process, can give you a kind of a way into maybe interpreting dreams.
Absolutely, although I don't like the word interpreting in relation to dreams, actually, because that puts the therapist in a position of being the expert.
Even though the client is paying?
Yes, I think it's always wrong for the therapist to play the role of an expert. I think the therapist is always a co-worker, so to speak, a co-explorer. Therapist opens themselves up. It's very relational. You see, the whole of therapy has become more relational in recent years. That's one of the great trends. And very peculiar, this is a book I've just seen on presenting a lot of different forms of therapy and so forth. There's hardly any mention of this extraordinary revolution that's taken place over the past 20 or 30 years in psychotherapy, where the emphasis is now all or so much on the relationship.
Even for analysts?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The analyst started it in 1989 or something or thereabouts. Late 80s, early 90s, there was this group of psychoanalysts who talked about intersubjectivity, that was the term, intersubjectivity, that therapy is not a question, or analysis is not a question of an analyst analysing an analysand. It's about intersubjectivity. And that was a shocking change. And it was so shocking, was the way in which it swept the board without anybody really commenting on it or questioning it or talking about it. Just swept the board. Everybody's reacting on that. I can't think of a thing of what psychotherapy. It doesn't claim to be more relational than everybody else. It's a remarkable change.
That mirrors the increased democratization. Mm. I mean, 89, you had the fall of the Berlin Wall and all the rest of it. Because I often think the 50s, with Rogers and others, that there was this greater democratic thrust in society. Oh, is that reflecting in counselling?
Well, humanistic psychology is far more democratic than anything that went before. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you'll notice is that at humanistic conferences, there's always time for questions at the end of every talk. Most other approaches to if it's a 60-minute talk, the guy talks for 60 minutes. Bingo, next, please, you know. Whereas humanistic psychology has this democratic quality to it. It doesn't matter whether it's Gestalt or whether it's psychodrama or whether it's anything. There's always room for dispute. Discussion, exploration, so forth. It's never presented as this is cut and dried and this is what you believe. Forget it about anything else. Yeah.
Cartwright mentions the one thing to be dogmatic about is not to be dogmatic.
Well, there's a danger in that, you see. I think being too dogmatic about that.
Well, I love what I think it was Oscar Wilde said, all generalizations are false, including this one.
Yeah.
Your birth year was 1925.
Yeah.
So if I may say, you're probably in your elder years.
I could say, you could say. Actually, it's a very nice statement, which I think it's useful that the 60s is the young old, the 70s is the middle old, the 80s is the old, and the 90s is the frail old.
Oh, right, okay.
I think that's rather good.
And you're about to enter the the 90s.
Yeah.
I'm at CCPE, and one of the courses that was a prerequisite before I went on there to postgraduate diploma was a basic skills weekend at the centre. And it's still been one of the most impressing little role plays I did, when we used this exercise, who are you? And you keep repeating, who are you?
Yeah.
And I still refer back to that as a point of reference. So if I said to you now, in your elder years, who are you? What would you say?
Well, it's a question of levels. You see, Wilbur is the clearest writer on this, I think. You see, at the mental ego level, who are you is really, I am who other people paint me as being. I have no sort of knowledge of my inner self, but if you tell me I'm a brilliant writer, I'm a brilliant writer. If you tell me I'm shit, you know. It's all about self-image rather than the self. At the central level, I see through my own eyes. I'm an authentic person. I'm an existential ego. I take responsibility for my life and the meaning of my life and so forth. So, in other words, I would answer at that level. I am a real self. I am me. I own my own reality, and I could create my own reality. So I am a real self. The next level is a subtle level, and at that level I am my soul. I am a spiritual being. I'm in touch with the divine. I own up to being on the same level with the gods, the goddesses, the angels, the devas, the trees, the water, the air, the sun, the rain, the sun, and so on, so forth. I am my soul. Brent Courtwright writes about this, the Antaratman. Mm-hmm. I am the Antaratman. At the next level, the causal level, there is no separate me or I. I am one with the universe. I am one with God. I am one with the ultimate. I am one with... there is only the one. And I'm it. Or part of it, or whatever way you like to put it. But there is only the one, and therefore my answer might be the shunyata, the void, the nothing. That's all I am, whatever. And then at the next level, the non-dual level, I'm just laughing because there's no answer to this. What are you talking about? The self, you know, bullshit, you know, forget it. You know. It depends what level I'm speaking from, mm-hmm. as to what my answer is to that question.
Mm-hmm. So, have you, in Jungian terms, dumped your shadow?
Yeah. I think so. I've spent 10 years doing that. Working through my all stuff that was holding me back from being a real self. And that's the shadow work.
So you became fully functioning?
Yes. Yeah. In 1980, I proclaimed myself to be a fully functioning person and fully self-actualized.
But your regular meditation videos,